Today we have Hamish, who is a director of Plus in New Zealand. We're going to have a very interesting conversation around the industry and the challenges that New Zealand faces, including the great brain drain. Let's jump on in.
Fabulous.
Hamish, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. So, Hamish, do you want to tell us, you're the director of Plus in New Zealand. Tell us a little bit about what you do and who Plus helps.
I'm one of two directors of Plus Studio in New Zealand. My business partner, Matthew Charles, runs our Christchurch office, and I'm sitting here in Auckland, where I lead the Auckland team. We're about 16 people or so across both offices. We operate as one business in two locations, so one in the north, one in the south of New Zealand. And who do we service? Well, we're a generalist practice, really. The DNA of Plus Studio originated in Melbourne and the design and construct ethos, I guess, that Australia does so well. And then Plus came to New Zealand about a decade ago, 11 or 12 years ago, actually, started in Christchurch. So one of the people from Plus Melbourne sort of was sent out to the colonize New Zealand, if you like, established an office in Christchurch, but then pretty quickly won a design for apartment tower here in Auckland.
Right. Was that, if you don't mind me asking, obviously Christchurch, was that the post-earthquake sort of rebuild? Would that sort of was a driver? Because there was a lot going on in New Zealand.
No, not necessarily. He was keen to just live somewhere differently. He always said that, if he wanted to live in Sydney or if he wanted to live in Brisbane, he would have gone there. But going to Christchurch just had that different feel. Christchurch still retains that feel that it has at the moment, even post-quake, all the rebuild of the city.
I'm a massive, if anybody's listened to the podcast before, I often talk about Kiwis seem to be my favourite people. Just get on with it. I just love the sense of humour. Sometimes I miss half of it, but
that's the vowels you can't understand.
Yeah, well, at least yours sounds better than ours does half the time. I prefer the New Zealand accent to a lot of Australian accents. You get off the plane, you come back into the Australian airport, and you're like, oh, my God, do we really sound like that? This is terrible.
Yeah. Don't worry. We have the same thing. When I moved home from some time in Melbourne and I heard the newsreader on the 6 o'clock news, one of the first times we turned it on, I was like, oh, my God, we really do sound like that.
It's just sort of what you get used to for a while. So, obviously, you've worked in, obviously, the Melbourne market and then New Zealand as well, and obviously a New Zealander by heart. Mm-hmm. I mean, New Zealand is one of those fantastic countries. I think, as you said in a bit of the prelude, it's the furthest away from lots of places. And as we also spoke about, that sometimes actually a lure for people too. I think it's an extraordinary country and obviously something that's one of the most beautiful countries in the world. So tell us obviously a little bit of your history as well and how you got to where you are today.
I'll try and give you the condensed version. I grew up in Manawatu, which is a rural region, a couple of hours north of Wellington. So I went to architecture school in Wellington, then kind of stuck around after that for a few years. I got registered in Wellington. Around the turn of the millennium, thought, well, it's time to look outside and see what else the world has to offer. And I took a trip across to Ireland, thinking that was the great savior of our industry, or perhaps the place
of milk and honey. That's always questionable. This is obviously pre GFC.
Oh yeah, quite some time pre, and it was the time of the Celtic Tiger, but its roar was becoming a lot more muted by then, and I thought, I'm not going to stick around here for just picking up what the pieces that are left. And I washed up in Melbourne after a little while. And thought this is a pretty cool place. I was getting pretty low on money, and my next employer in Wellington reached out to me and said, oh, we've just won a project for the new Inter-Islander ferry terminal. Do you want to come back and lead that? I thought, oh, well, at least that's something, so I could go do that for a while. That never got built, but worked on that for a spell, and then headed back to Melbourne and did just over 2 years.
Yeah.
A few practices around Melbourne, which was great because it was exposure to different market. You know, whilst Australia and New Zealand are very similar, we've got some little intricacies which differ between us. And
what do you say they are? Because I obviously work nationally and across all.
Yeah.
It's that
We don't have a federal system, so we are New Zealand. You know? We don't have states. We have New Zealand, and then we have some councils.
Yeah,
we have. I think we have near.
It's not this middle band you find with us in comparison to state.
Well, look, we've got enough bureaucracy here to go around as it is, so we don't need to add all that rubbish on top. But you know, population wise, we are smaller than Melbourne.
Yeah,
in totality. And so, look, it's market scale, right?
Yeah.
Australia offers that you know, sort of the worldly scale that we probably miss here.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd just say, look, just back to Pacifica, it's New Zealand's tallest residential building still. It's 54 stories.
Yeah, right.
And the majority of world cities, if you like, that's kind of peanuts, right? So. It's by degrees, but you know, our scale brings the delight of living here.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's also, you talked about that being a diverse firm, right? You can't just be in the living sector. You have to be across multiple different elements because it is a different population. There's different regions, different elements that you need to consider in that, in what you're actually, you know, you're talking about councils and what they'll allow, but also in communities and who's who and who knows who. But also, you know, working to the typology, not to the typology, the geography of the diversity of which you've got in the country as well.
Yeah, but again, it's a matter of scale, right? If you said you're only going to design, I don't know, I'm looking out of the window here at a very, very large church. So I'll say, if you're only going to design churches, you're probably going to run out of clients pretty quickly here. but that just sort of speaks to my nature of liking diversity. Maybe I get bored easily, but I really like to jump between typologies. I love the whole spectrum of architecture, and I love something new.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I'm a bit of a magpie. Maybe I like the new shiny, bright stuff, you know, the sort of the promise of what lies ahead. But when it comes down to architecture, it's architecture is all about people.
That's really right.
It's all about humanity, and it's just understanding how people are thinking and how you could give them back those thoughts as a built representation, you know. I mean, that's the real buzz of it.
Well, and that's what I love. And I was just in Sydney. We had a bit of a chat about that beforehand, right? And I've lived in Melbourne too. And it's fantastic when you see where areas are activated. And this is why I love, you know, I walk around, my partner's like, you know, we're both at this event waiting for us. I'm like, I love how much effect our industry can have. That essentially by doing good design, not from an architectural point of view, but even from town planning, even from an urban plan point of view, taking something that was and then creating the entire ethos and community and spaces that people want to be in. It's absolutely brilliant. And that's the fantastic thing about, you know, doing what I do and working with people. We're working with people who are working on large scale, thinking about the next 30 years, to people working down, you know, to the smallest innate part of, you know, what's the desk made out of and what are we doing from the interior's point of view. And I'm sure you find
that. Yeah, exactly. And which screw you have to put this part A to fix to part B. I mean, it's a privilege, right? It's a privilege to be able to operate in that sort of environment, which has so much effect on people's lives.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible, and I absolutely and utterly adore it and love it every day. So you're obviously throughout that, it seems like you've explored the world.
I was kind of up to Melbourne, then we got distracted. So I came to Auckland in 2004. So I was working That practice I went back to Melbourne for, went back to Wellington for before going to Melbourne, as part of a national group, yeah. If you like. You know, it was a bit like a New Zealand wide group. It's kind of from a studio. We're an Australasian group at the moment. And the Auckland company said, oh, we need somebody like you. Do you want to come? I said, oh, yeah. Let's go have a look. So that was in 04. And so I've been in Auckland since then.
Wow. There we go. 20 years now. It just can't.
22, my dear. 22.
Oh, sorry. I must say, I often have to look down. I'm like losing. I think it's the older you get, the more you're losing the years. I'm like, oh, no, we're in 2026.
Well, I think the older you get, the faster time goes, right?
There is an entire.
We're recording this on 1 May. I mean, how did that happen?
So let's so then obviously throughout your career you've flown around, you've done different things, and then you've ended up being a director as well. Yep. So how did all of that sort of come about, from going from just being an architect into turning into a director of a firm?
Well, the second practice I moved to in Auckland after maybe 2.5 years is where I weathered out the GFC, and we did some neat stuff at that place. And we also, actually the GFC, seeing as you raised it earlier, I got a phone call. I'll never forget this. 5 p.m. on a Thursday, we were doing an apartment building for a client. And they said, stop drawing now. Stop everything. And that kind of speaks to, in many ways, the architects of the canary in the coal mine of the economy, because it's pretty hard to ring your builder and say, yeah, don't pour that concrete slab at 6 a.m. tomorrow that you've got 20 concrete trucks turning up for. That doesn't happen. But you tell your architect to stop drawing lines.
I think most other people, I mean, that is the GFC. People don't realize how quickly it hit and, essentially how quickly everybody has to put funding on hold and what effect that had. I mean, I know people personally who unfortunately went bankrupt during the GFC.
There were some terrible consequences.
Yeah. And this is, and I think this is the fact. I mean, we sort of had a bit of this conversation before of, you know, generally you will see an economic cycle of every 8 to 12 years and you'll see go down and rebuild. I think we're very interesting time now of what we're dealing with, that, you know, COVID had an effect. It meant a lot of governments, you know, if we look at Melbourne in comparison, or we can talk about the effects in New Zealand, you know, trying to do a lot to keep everybody safe and do that, but also had terrible effects in the built environment. So I'm personally from Melbourne, watching businesses in the entire city essentially that had evolved over and been activated over 30 years kind of overnight turn off and hasn't really, I don't think, recovered in the same way. And then what that has then just meant with obviously interest rates, and we've, you know, got massive inflation rates going on as we're recording this right now, that's having massive economic effects. And you know, that's, I think, something we spoke about before, is that often people are in the industry haven't actually experienced a downturn yet.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? I was, so my final year of uni was 93, and there was an Asian financial crisis at the time.
And the recession we had to have in Australia, that's what Paul Keating said.
I'm not quite sure if I'm remembering this correctly. I think I am, but I'm quite sure our lecturers took delight in telling us that we'd be bloody lucky to get a job when we left, because, you know, 2 or 3 years prior to our graduation year, that was the case. A whole lot of people left the country, et cetera. And yet, when we came out in 94 and started looking for jobs, my recollection is everybody that wanted a job got a job. And so that was timing. So what I did was I always like to make things, and I made these beautiful little boxes for a CV. You know, you got to stand out. You got to be a bit different. And so I looked at, back in the day, Yellow Pages. I look at a map of Wellington. And I go, all right, I'll start from the top end of town and I'll work down. And I spent a lot of money at the time and laser color copying. It just sort of become commercially available. I had all this bloody stuff in my bag. And, of course, the first one I go into, I get a bloody job.
you didn't even have to work that hard. That's the best outcome.
No, exactly.
And I think
till I got registered. And that was just, you know, I got a good technical learning from there as well. But they had a lot of faith in me and just let me go for it.
I think that's, there's two things I've picked up with in that story. One is that sometimes in this industry, it is just the luck of when you come out. You could come out now and it can be a bit tough. But it's also where, you know, for example, right now, if you want to come to Queensland, don't say this to New Zealanders, obviously, but for you guys, but, you know, it's actually rocking, and then another economy is it's not. So, you know, working on the
don't worry, we're fully aware of that. And, I think we like to talk about the brain drain.
Yes, although, I do actually want to talk about the brain drain. That was just what I was going to get into, because that is actually New Zealand's greatest export, I believe, is the amazing professionals that leave.
And here was I thinking it was milk, wool, and beef. There you are. It's our greatest loss.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if export. I mean, I think it's about losing talent.
And but, so how does New Zealand deal with that? Also, because obviously Australia's the first ones who we profit from that, right? But
CER, right? So we can just turn up and work there. I think was it Johnny Howard who made, one of your PMs made our access to Medicare, et cetera. It required a bit longer to stick around to get that. But we had a prime minister in the, he probably said this in the early 80s, that New Zealander moving to Australia raises the IQ of both countries. So take from that what you will. but it is, look, it is a constant thing that we sort of, you know, fret about over here.
Yeah.
But I think
but
the
like
less
your
we worry
story,
about
though,
that, the more we just get on
you,
with it, right?
You go out, you get to experience different things, and then you come back.
Of course.
For the reason. And I often do find there is a part where people get to a sort of stage in life, and it's generally that wanting to have the kids and that part where it's like, you know, I actually need the support network or what I need around or that amazing lifestyle that I had. So in essence, you know, I always say that people often go off, they get experience. And I think that's one of the great things about what professionals in this industry can do as well.
Yep.
And architecture in particular. It is an international profession, right? You know, like I have a commerce and law degree, and I didn't want to necessarily do law, but I think about it, it's like you've got to go and get re-registered. There's a lot more. If you want to be a medico, you've got to go. Yes, architects, it's still not registered. You need to go through local, but there's a lot more. And now there's the, you know, it's not for New Zealand, but there's this whole sort of realm of now going with how can we make it easier for people to get registered. And in most countries, there is a, you know, if you're going to the UK or Australia from New Zealand or bounds coming back, there is obviously recognition within that. It's a little bit to do, but you can still go and get a job and still practice quite
easily. Well, I got a little bit of insight into that because I'm a registration assessor for New Zealand.
Oh, great.
Architects Board. I've done that for a little while. And we've got reciprocal agreements with a whole lot of other countries, but you know, APEC is a really good group of countries of which we have those kind of rights. Includes the USA, but USA is a bit crazy, obviously, for its various states, as you blokes are as well. You know, I was registered in Victoria. I maintained that for a while because it kind of felt cool. And then I was like, why the hell am I spending this money every year, and I'm only working in New Zealand? It doesn't quite make sense. So, I mean, we're doing some work with some American architects at the moment.
Yeah.
That's another thing I wanted to talk about is how we really, really love partnering with other architects. And I think that's showing a lot of the history of PLUS. Through Australia, but it's kind of an ethos that we really dig here. You can't be everywhere all at once. You can't be an expert at everything all at once. So why not bring in some mates and just try and have a bit of a good party of it?
Well, I think that's actually a good, we'll talk about the challenges a bit, but I think that is actually one of the opportunities for things that is ahead. I mean, we had a podcast on doing JVs and partnerships and more with clients, we're having that conversation that, you know, the future may not be large organizations, it may be. And if you look at architects, so often people don't realise this, that 75 to 80% of businesses across the industry, but particularly for architects, it's quite large, are actually under 10.
Oh, yeah.
And then you're only talking a few 1 or 2% who are actually open. Now, for architects, you know, if you're looking at the engineering firms, a lot of the engineering firms are big internationals, because as soon as you kind of get to a size, the engineers just love getting to a size, selling out, and then being bought out by a big firm.
That's I've got my own story of that.
Yeah,
that,
please do.
Yeah. Oh, now?
Yeah.
Okay. So after the GFC, I moved to a practice called Creative Spaces, which is was pretty well established here in Auckland, and office in Wellington. And Creative Spaces was essentially half architecture, half interior design, but also had a fit-out management side. So kind of build the interior designs as well.
A little bit of D&C element there, yeah.
D&B, as we like to call it.
Okay, here. All right.
Design and build. Anyway, and then lo and behold, an offer turns up from one of those big multinationals called GHD. Anyway, by that time I was a director at Creative Spaces, and so we ended up selling for many complicated reasons, of which it's probably a whole other podcast itself, but we will just accept the fact that we sold. And I got to GHD and they said, well, you can run architecture for New Zealand. So that was interesting, because I'd always traditionally worked in smaller practices.
Yeah.
That's always been my overriding desire. You know, I've kind of talked to some of the bigger ones over the years, but maybe it's just me, but I always had a fear I'd just be a number in the machine.
Yeah.
And so I turned up the big multinational and essentially you're a number in a machine. And, you know, we were really, really concerned about our business culture surviving.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, it's just by the nature of it. You go from a company of, I think we were about 30 people when we moved across town, to a multinational multi-dis of around 10,000 people. You know, of course your culture is going to get swamped. So maybe we're deluding ourselves. But no, anyway, it was a really fascinating experience as much as anything else.
Well, actually, and it could be a whole other podcast because it gives you a whole in itself, because that is one of the things when people are often thinking about succession and you know, some firms want to build up to have that done. And sometimes there's a knock on the door. Other times there's a process that you're, you know, going through to potentially find if there's that right. I think the other interesting thing is architecture firms becoming part of multi-dis firms or sort of more engineering led. How was that experience? What was that like? Because there's pros and cons, and everybody will have a different experience.
100%. I think what became evident quite quickly was that the architects, as we tend to naturally adopt the position of lead consultant. So I found myself having to go and apologize on behalf of the multi-dis teams for some things that hadn't gone quite well on projects. And I'm like, well, gee, I just turned up. I don't really know what's going on here, but I'm sorry. You know, but we would tend to assemble the project teams within the company, right, and go and pull all the various parts together. We'd also then be responsible for the financial performance of the projects. And it was a bit like herding cats at times. You know, such a big organization. But when it worked really well. I realized after a while it wasn't really my primary motivation and how I wanted to operate as an architect. And, I'm definitely much more at home here at Plus, where we had a rebrand in ourselves. So we've been Plus Architecture for the whole existence of the company. Now we're trading as Plus Studio. And so we're sort of, the term architecture has morphed into studio because we want to be seen as being able to provide all sorts of design responses.
Yeah.
You know, so And it's interesting, even here, you know, tried to go for, we have one and successfully delivered some interiors projects, but sometimes people say, well, why would we want to employ you? You're architects. Right? Well, okay, you know, that's a bit blunt. So, look, it felt like the time was right.
Yeah.
Spongy,
well, it's funny too, isn't it?
Off we go.
Because at the end of the day, it is design. But it's just
exactly. You were mentioning earlier, you know, the privilege of working in a industry that looks about, you know, placemaking, kind of, if you like. And it's really interesting. You know, one of the things I loved about Creative Spaces, well, it was really overt about architecture and interiors, because I've always struggled with the concept that the architect does a building. The interior designer does the interiors, the landscape architect does the outside bits to the boundary, and then an urban designer might do a streetscape. It's so fragmented. And of course, when things are fragmented, they don't properly knit together, do they? So my philosophy is that architecture has never started and stopped at the front door. You know, it's about the entire sort of process of approaching a building and experiencing the building inside, outside, you know.
Well, and the funny thing is, that's what you learn at university, right? And
then it comes out. Design courses, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, look, the first job I was in Wellington was awesome. We did a huge amount of work for Air New Zealand. So within a year, I was sort of flying around sorting out Air New Zealand lounges. I mean, you're in Queensland. Just so happened that we coincided with the new Brisbane airport. And so I went to Brisbane for a day, and I remember taking the signage, which was made in Wellington, and bag across with me to be installed. And then I had to go and set out all the furniture according to our furniture plans.
Amazing.
And that was a real buzz for a dumb kid from Manawatu, you know, 1 year into his career. And I remember the immigration dudes at Brisbane Airport gave me a hell of a hard time because I was carrying in commercial goods and not declaring them for a duty or whatever. And I had to say, whoever the guy was at the who ran the airport, I said, can you just give, let's say, Mick, that's a good Aussie name, and can you just give Mick a call? And let's just call him Mick. But I remember he was really into galahs. He was like, pink and grey, mate. Colours of Queensland. Anyway, that was a laugh. But interiors was incredibly inherent to that business.
Yeah.
And it just made sense to me.
Well, and it is. I mean, I worked for a firm called Grey Pucks, and there's a lot of firms that, you know, it's coming from that. We used to talk about, you know, building from the inside out, right? Yep. So, and that is coming from that. Yeah, architects are the interior, but interior architecture and, or, you know, interior design, whichever you want to put on it. I mean, most of the time, you know, we've got clients who are like, they might be interiors doing architecture. They might be landscape working. And that's where I think this world of partnerships is important and moving forward. But also, I mean, it's quite funny to somebody who's not in it. It's, you know, here's somebody who, if you go in to talk to a developer, I don't care, I just need it done. Like, what are you allowed to sign off on and what aren't you allowed to sign off on? Like, just to
look,
just
want
the job done.
And how much do you need to do for building consent? Yeah. What can we get away with? You know, I don't want to pay you really anything because I'm begrudgingly engaging you. And that's a theory I've been developing for many years as well. We're kind of a discretionary profession, you know. It's like, well, I need the structural engineer because I need a building to stand up, and I need the mechanical engineer because I like a bit of air conditioning, but bloody architects, you know. And you hear that so often. You know, that's been a refrain on site forever, right? Oh, it's the bloody architect's fault. You know?
And it's quite unusual, though, because when you interview people from across the globe, and then you talk to different people. I mean, a lot of architecture sits sometimes in engineering. And there are some countries in the world, and I would say actually majority, except for Australia, where I think the power of the architect and New Zealand sounds like it's been the same sort of slow whittling away of the influence and the power of the architect. But most of the architects are running the entire thing. And everybody on site, the builders, everybody's good. So when they come to Australia and then they go, okay, you know, look, you're not going to be doing a lot of that. You're going to be doing a bit more of this. Oh, Okay. Mm. And it's just the dynamics and the respect. And it's very interesting how that has happened in our region.
Yeah. Well, you just need to look at the origin or derivation of the word architect. You know, it meant master builder. And you know, now we're at the point. Well, look, when I started my career, we were doing our own fire reports. There was no such thing as a facade engineer. It's been really fascinating to watch sort of the iteration or almost the fracturing of disciplines into into slivers of service. Yeah. So whereas if you just take architecture as an example, we used to do almost all in the round. You know, Frank Lloyd Wright famously did his own structural engineering. Well, that's the urban myth anyway. And there's the beautiful photo of sort of the big sort of mushroom shaped columns with the beautiful round caps on them at Johnson Wax Building, and they said that's never going to work, Mr. Wright. And so he got loads and loads of bags of cement loaded up on top, and then they just kept loading it, you know. And turned out Mr. Wright knew a thing or two. Although, and I went on a bit of a Wright pilgrimage in the US straight after uni, and I went to Falling Water, which is a bit of a haul to get to be honest. And I like to tell people it was actually falling into the water because Wright's famous cantilevers had gone on the grog a bit too much. They were like, no, we're going to have to rebuild this.
Well, I think it is that, I mean, nowadays there's just a lot of risk. And if we look at, you know, I don't know if you had the same problems, but, well, obviously we did probably from the UK and where all the insurances came after all of that, those fires and specifying, and you see those in different ways. I think as a profession, architects are quite risk adverse sometimes in doing it. So it's the design, but I don't want to take that risk on. This would be it doesn't mean Scodley, this is my observations. And we've seen the power of project managers coming in a lot more, and has changed, whereas architects are still the project managers on certain size of projects. It's just sometimes
it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we have a lot of conversations here about, you know, about those sort of allied disciplines, and a lot of times we could do that. But when it boils down to it, when you're in a really big, complex project, yes, you really need those people piling on in. As long as you're all, you know, sort of rowing in the same direction,
absolutely.
Then generally they add value. But it's, you know, it's like, I guess it's like anything, right? There's the bad apples kind of sour your impression.
Well, it's also when people get the politics, and I think that's one of the biggest things is that. One of the most important skills is, as you said, it's all about people, right? Like we've mentioned this before, project can either be going really well or it can go really badly. And majority of the time has not much to do with project, has more to do with the people involved.
Oh, look, absolutely. And, you know, I like to try and espouse the facts of life to my graduates here. But I tend to tell them we're really a game of two things. We're in the communications industry, you know, because we don't actually make anything except a set of instructions on how to put something together. You know? So we're kind of like the super people at the back of IKEA making all the flat pack drawings and things, right? And we're also in the game of psychology. I'm like, you can't, as I mentioned earlier, you can't do that sort of that built representation and return to a client's brief if you don't understand the client. And to understand the client or their briefs, you need to understand the people, not only the people that are asking to do something, but the people who are going to occupy it, the people who could potentially occupy it, and yada yada yada. I had a bit of a thought about this before this recording, and I was trying to think about buildings where people aren't involved, and can't think any. I mean, I thought, zoos, of course. No, zoos of people. So, look, it's...
I was thinking car parks, and I was like, well, no, you're moving people in and out. No, that's not it.
Yeah, well, somehow somebody's got to be able to instinctively drive in and not get lost and drive into a column, as a dear client of mine said a couple of weeks ago. Oh, the column jumped out at me. You know, Okay.
It's
all about sort of a response to humanity, right?
Yeah.
And to get there, you've got to find a level of communication and understanding with the people who you're working for and with. And, you know, when it comes to contractors, there's nothing better. Seriously, there is nothing better than a site that is going really, really well. And you can feel it, that everybody's, you know, all heading in that same direction. And that kind of extends to other consultants as well.
Yeah.
Without being arrogant about it, I say to my engineer friends, I say, look, the biggest professional compliment I can give you is that you're an architect's engineer. And that sounds incredibly cocky, but most of them get it. They go, yeah, I know. Because we have to come up with that almost sometimes ephemeral response to somebody's brief, their desire. And then we have to, if you like, sell them the dream. You've got to get them excited into it. You've got to, you know, show them this response to each of these items, which is really important to them. And we've done that. And then we bring in the engineering squads, you know, and if they can buy into that belief.
Figure out how it's going to make it work and stand
Exactly. But, you know, by the same time, we're not so arrogant that we're going to say, no, that's it. You know, if the engineer says he's got to stick a column right there, you know, well, we're actually good enough designers that we can incorporate that.
Yeah. And figure out, what it's going to be.
But it's like, you know, it's a job of people for people. It's not rocket science.
Oh, and I think that's one of the things. You go to university and you learn all about, you know, you're talking the design, or if you're an engineer, you're learning about this, or, you know, project managers, it's all about how we're actually going to make it happen. And, you know, the builders is how we're going to actually coordinate a bunch of people on site to actually build this and materials where we're going to get it from.
Yeah.
It is 100% a people game at the end of the day. And I mean, there can be challenges I've spoken about, but it can be also the joy of it, of actually having, it's, I think, one of the best things that you guys get to do, right? I deal with people, right? But I don't have anything tangible to walk past. If I do something, 2 or 3 years later, things could change dramatically. Hopefully you find, have you had an impact on somebody's life? You guys literally get to go past a building, and everybody who's in this game loves it, that I had something to do with that. You know, I built that, right? Yeah. So with the architect, or I designed this element, or the engineer made that happen, or the builder, or the tradesperson, I had something to do with that. And the thing is that you get this legacy of tangible things. There are very, very few professions and very, very few industries, except for this one, where that exists.
Gee, I hope my grads are listening to this. But that's the privilege of it all, right?
Yeah.
That's, you know, in reality, we are in a very privileged position. You know, clients give us lots and lots of money. Well, figuratively speaking.
Don't quite give so much money. They've got this problem. How do you optimize this? And
let me rephrase that. They let us,
how can you do
they
it
let
with
us
the
use
money
their budgets wisely. All right. But there's responsibility and there's reward in that, and it's really gratifying.
Well, and that's what we spoke about before. Obviously, we've had Nick on, one of your counterparts, on, and that is it. You can design something. An architect's role is also to create more value. Now, sometimes that can be a monetary value, right? You know, if it's in a commercial part, how do you create value? Something that has more esoteric value? Perhaps somebody wants to stay in the same spot, but this is, you know, I now live in a spot where I just do not understand how they did the design. Terrible, terrible design in the 90s or 80s in the Gold Coast. They needed to get better architects, right?
You mean it's a suburb or it's a building?
No, just in general. Like, it's just, I don't understand how, working with architects, things were designed in the way they're designed. Zero consideration for environments and even sun placement and stuff like that. But that's a whole other thing in itself.
Well, no, not necessarily, because you need to acknowledge that not every project is a dream, and you don't always feel, I'm so lucky to be doing this, because sometimes, you know, the constraints are such that, wow, look at this, you could do this. No, we've got to do it this way. Okay, all right. But in the end, there's a need, and we need to deliver against the need, right? So one of our things is, There's no egos here, right?
Yeah.
This is, we're not here for our gratification. We're actually a professional services company. And architects have this real dilemma of, are we artists or are we actually the master builder? You know, so can we be airy fairy and flighty and can we come up with the craziest design in the world? But also, geez, we've got to stop the water coming in that in a downpour, you know?
Well, that's right. And they're the practical elements. And I think that was one of the things that Nick spoke about. In a market where things are quite tough, it's how can you actually create the most amount of value? That's actually a challenge in itself. When you talk about that artist, I think sometimes, you know, sometimes there's the architectural element of people want to make things beautiful, but then there's the element of how do we actually design? What is design? It's, you know, you can go through all the theories, form and function, I think, you know, whether it's actually figuring out, but you've got to work to the problem that's being solved and what are the constraints. And sometimes the constraints are that you're not going to get to put in, you know, fittings and fixtures of a certain value or it's going to be this much per square meter. But sometimes with the smallest budgets, it's how do you actually create the best outcomes without necessarily needing to change?
Look, I'll tell you something. I've always found it much easier to design with constraints than I have to be given a blank sheet of paper and just say, give us something. So maybe that's the way I'm made. But, you know, budgets are one of those elements. Yeah. You're always considering. And sometimes clients don't like to divulge the budgets to us. And we get quite robust arguments with them. Come on, you know, we've done this once or twice before. And we need to have that as part of our toolkit of references of how we are going to respond to your brief. Right? If it's this much a square meter or if it's this many millions or whatever versus this, then we have quite a different response.
Different
to
conversation.
It. But just on what is architecture, I mean, we were taught in architecture school about a dude called Vitruvius back in Roman Empire times.
Yeah.
And Vitruvius, as I understand it, he wrote a treatise to suck up to the boss man at the time, was a Caesar or Pope or whoever. Anyway, he defined in Latin, which I won't attempt to do, but essentially architecture boils down to three things, and it's firmness, commodity, and delight. Right, so firmness means the thing's got to stand up. So there's our good friends, the architect's engineer. Commodity is essentially it's got to do what the client wanted it to do. You know, I wanted an office building. I actually didn't want to have a hydro slide in it and half a zoo on the ground floor and, you know, So firmness and commodity you can take care of pretty easily. But delight has always been my driver. Yeah, and delight can be interpreted so many different ways. Delight can be that you simply maxed out the commercial opportunities of this building and your client's making a whole bunch of money and you see the grin on their face and that's nothing more than delight. Or what's actually quite a lovely thing when you've got one of those constrained budgets, and I can remember the odd government department we've worked for and they walk in at the end and they go, oh my God, I didn't know you could do that. You know, and that's a really visceral expression of it. And they turn around with this big smile and they're almost brought to tears, you know, because it's like, oh, we started from nothing and you helped us to get this. You know, so you know, I tend to wave my arms around quite a bit at presentations and things, and you know, some of them out there they'll just sort of roll their eyeballs and go, "Here he goes again about delight." But I think I'm quite passionate about it because it is really what's needed from architecture. Yeah.
Well, it's a bit like, you know, you're making dinner, right? And you can do it, and then somebody makes it, and it's like, that's good. It's giving me food. It's a standard. And then somebody else does, and that's like, and I'm terrible. I don't cut things up fine enough. My partner's very different. And then it's just a little bit of spice. Like I had noodles yesterday. It wasn't really much in this noodle soup, but it was just like the mixture of the coriander and this. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is, you know, it's absolutely brilliant. It was after an after party, so it might have been a bit of a hangover element in there too. But I was.
Yeah, you're probably completely misremembering it.
But my point is, and I think that is, like, in essence, if you are going to look at that delight part, the architect's job is like the chef's job. is to figure out how you add that element or that spice or whatever definition you want to give that delight whilst keeping those two other elements.
Interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, like the chef, we've made so many dinners ourselves, right? And we've got our secret sauces. We've got tricks up our sleeves.
Yeah.
But we've also got that really well-organized spice rack there. You know, so have a bit of that and some of that and quite a bit of that one. Thank you very much. And how does this all taste to you? Oh, my God, the delight's amazing. You know, and that's, for me, that's where the fun in this game
is. Yeah, it is. And, I mean, it is. I mean, we often, you know, the first thing we ask architects is, you know, why did you want to get into this, right? And the reason we ask that, it gives us so much insight into the person and what drives them, because architecture, unfortunately, is not the best out of the entire circle of the industry to get remunerated. It is an area of passion. But I will say, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, there's very, very few people who I think can reach self-actualization, right? Whereas I think a lot of people in the architecture industry do get to realize that, right? Just get to work towards a passion.
Yeah. I think we're too quick to forget that in this game.
Yeah.
I think we're too quick to forget the amount of privilege that we have, but also the amount of trust that people put in us. In reality, you know, we turn out a couple of renders and we can do all sorts of things these days, and fly-throughs. And personally, I miss the days of sitting at home and building little models and then putting them in front of the client, because the coolest thing, and I think this is what I used to do as a grad.
Yeah.
I used to spend weekends building models and I bring it in. The client come in without an exception. The first thing they do is put their face down and look in the window. It's hilarious. But, you know, these days we just drop a city. The city's already modeled, and we do sun studies and wind studies and all sorts of things. Just click a couple of buttons. It's absolutely
amazing. It is built with 3D if you do want it handled. But there is nothing, and it is the thing that, you know, you just, and it's funny when you look at some people's followers and you see those models, or people still do build, you're like, you wish, but it's just not. Look, I've known in our processes that observing there, that is actually sometimes the most important part. Sometimes people still go and just build it out, get a little bit of material and just see and play with what that actually looks like. Because there is something about, it's a bit like typing. And these days, you know, we can all just dictate into our phones and it can write half of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I still, you know, I've gone from writing to-do lists and doing all this. I still go back to handwriting, because neurologically there is a connection that we have with our brains that we have then with our hands. And I think there is an element that you're still in actually building the model. I wonder how much that is actually, you're really getting a real esoteric understanding of the form.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, look, we've just been doing performance reviews here, so this is quite timely. And I'm like, you know, show me the passion that you have in this, because you're a young professional. I can give you as much as I possibly can to grow you, but it's got to come from within you. You've got to want it. And that, you know, an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, you know, it's sort of the generalizing, of course, but it's usually the difference between being okay and being pretty good and better. And I do try and get my grads to sketch, you know, just getting lost in the computer. Look, Revit we use predominantly.
I mean,
it's absolutely amazing, but it also does my head in, because they're sitting there concerned about millimeter accuracy when we're maybe in a preliminary design, and I don't care. I want us to understand this thing in its totality and all the responses that it needs to do. It's got to model this. Well, let's just start sketching it. And so, you know, I'm the dinosaur here. I'm not allowed to touch the Revit because I'm pretty good at breaking it. But I really do enjoy sketching. And I started on a drawing board, right? And I used to have to storyboard my set of drawings and get my boss to approve it. And then, you know, you had to be very careful what you drew, because you then had to go and hand print it and, you know,
yeah.
You made a mistake. think. Well, if you couldn't scratch it out, there was a pretty good chance you had to go get another sheet of tracing paper and kind of start again. And you were looked at pretty sideways when you did that, right? And so I think that's always instilled in me an idea of composition, which I think is not only in how we set up drawing, but it's also how you compose a building and also perhaps how you compose your argument to sell a design for a building, et cetera. And I do have some concerns that the stuff that I was brought up on is now is not really valued. And I can see that is to a degree to the detriment of our industry. And you know, if we were to talk about AI and just the instant auctioneering that you can get through AI, look, don't get me wrong, all of this stuff is awesome and we use all of this. But at its heart, I think there is a risk of losing that that human interaction that I keep referring to. Right?
Yeah. Well, that's actually one of the interesting things just because I'm looking at the time sort of finishing off on. I mean, I look at it, so you look at it, you know, if you're interviewing, so you were saying the 1990s, 2000s, and then AutoCAD started coming in sort of early 2000s, Revit 3D sort of late, you tell me if I'm correct in my... And then I
you're being a bit late with your estimations, but yeah. Give me
the timelines. We've done drawing boards all the way up until probably
I can give you my timeline, but I was a bit of a late adopter in hindsight. But I don't really have any regrets for anything I've done in my career. Everything's been something to learn.
It's all a journey.
I didn't move off the board wholeheartedly until. Oh, well, actually, in reality, when I moved to Melbourne and I got a job and I said, I'm sweet at AutoCAD. And they go, cool, you start Monday. And I thought, oh, shit. I could draw some lines, but I was pretty crap. And then I had to use MicroStation in Melbourne, which nearly made me want to jump off the building. It was awful. Then some SketchUp along the way, more AutoCAD. Early days of some Revit, which was fantastic. More SketchUp, more AutoCAD. And now it's sort of at the level of sketching. And
so Revit's about probably 15 years. Most people can't sort of start to pick it up around 2009. I think all go.
I was using it in 04, well, 05, 06.
Okay, all right. And then
doing sort of feasibility design studies in it too.
Yeah, and before that, we've got 2D of AutoCAD and a few earlier other versions of 3D coming in the sort of early 2000s, So my point is...
Don't get ARCHICAD in there as well, and ARCHICAD's still a mainstay for a lot of practices.
Especially for small firms, it still is. I suppose where my point to this is that I sort of look ahead and I go, well, where's this AI and where's this technology come? But then the other day when I was interviewing somebody, we were going through a bit of it, and it sort of just occurred to me that we're talking about the next 10 to 20 years. But if we actually go back the last 20 years, right? Now, mind you, I'm born in the 80s, sort of grew up in the 90s, and now when they start to talk about the 90s being like 30 years ago, I'm still like, what? What are you talking about? That wasn't that long ago.
Try being my age, my dear.
But my point is that in your career, right? Yep. So let's say a general career is probably about 40 years. Yep. In your career, it's already changed that much. And we're so fearful of the change, and it's going to happen so quickly. We're talking about mega speeds. This stuff is changing and evolving. It's going to change a bit slower in our industry, I think, when it comes to actually producing beyond beautiful pictures. And as Nick, your counterpart, said, you know, it's just another architect, really, and providing more options. But I think there's this big thing of, oh, where it's going to be. But if we actually take a bit of a spec out, in the lifetime or the career of multiple people in the industry now, it's already changed so much fundamentally. So is it not just another tool and another way and doing that? But it comes back to what you were talking about, drawing board and using hands and sketches. Obviously look at it from a neurological point of view of that, the different skills, right? So if you're doing AutoCAD, you're still learning how to build. You're just doing it with a certain line. You start to get into different 3D parts. You know, it depends how well your Revit's set up, if you've got families and standards and all of that stuff. So it comes as more pop in. I have a feeling, and I will be surprised if it doesn't, but with the building codes being, you know, quiet and have people having standard ways of building things, I predict in the next 5 years the documentation will be the next semi-automated element that will come. Love to hear your thoughts on that.
No, I can't disagree with you. I see AI, well, okay, so I get quite frustrated with our Revit software. I see, you know, the whole sort of technology industry just evolving almost by the month at the moment. This AI to me just represents sort of a catch-all idea of how things are evolving at haste. So our 3D software is a big cumbersome beast. I would hope that if you talk about compliance, for example, I would be hoping that say Revit or a plug-in engine on it would be referring to the building code, and we would be getting live referencing in there of compliance. I would also expect, I think you're quite right, I'd also expect that documentation is at least, say, for argument's sake, 50% assembled for us.
Yeah.
And say, well, you know, you've got a concrete beam and a concrete column, and you've got a bit of steel and some timber and what have you, and a window coming in. Well, this is the general way it's assembled, and you take that as a framework and you develop that up. And it's, yeah, you know, because virtually every building we draw is bespoke nature, right? That's an interesting thing about what we do. So I think that's probably where we're heading. There's also obviously the rendering front engine is unbelievable, and some of the things that Autodesk Format can do for front end feasibility studies are just amazing. You know,
taking weeks into hours in comparison.
Well, I used to have to go down to the council in Wellington and line up and ask for a photocopy of an aerial photo of an area of the city of which there was a big grid out of reception. So I want, you know, I want F4, please. And, you know, we just instantly dial up the site, gives us 3D photo, I should say. Or rendered photo, at least, out of, I don't know, whatever pulls into Format.
The
boundaries around, we can turn on or off the, you know, the contours, create sections immediately. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. But it's not a huge iterative change from what we've already done. You know, it's just a different way of doing it. It's faster, and we digital, and so we can send a drawing to a client immediately, etc. But fundamentally, the same process has to exist. It's just that there will probably be automation. The only thing is that, there's a couple of things, I guess, is how much do you trust the computer? And also, where's the delight?
And I think that's going to be the interesting thing, because at the end of the day, AI doesn't think it's going to learn from a bunch of principles. And, I mean, that's where our brains work anyway. We do learn from, but it's that I'm part of coming up with fresh ideas and fresh things.
Yeah, well, but you know, by the nature of AI, it's mined existing ideas, right? I mean, Dr. Paul Walker, he used to take us for theory and crit when I was at Victoria University. And he famously said to us all, there's nothing new in architecture. And this was in 1992, 1993, you know. So at the time, there's sort of ideas of collage and things, right? So it's just, and maybe that's what happens in the head, right, of the architect, that we just take bits that work. But some of the things that are coming out in AI can't actually be built, right?
Exactly.
So AI will give you a potential render of something, but then you've got the whole construction industry, and there's no way they are, you know, flying ahead with AI. So you've got this big disjoint that still needs to be addressed somehow. I mean, sure, there's robotic demolition machines now, and there's also augmented reality, you know, builders are doing all that sort of thing. Well, that's cool, but it still doesn't build anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? So we've got physical constraints there too.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is probably coming back to the conversation around new learning. And it's about our brains and how we learn. It'll be very interesting to see what's going on. Because, I mean, if we think in the last century, how quickly everything has changed dramatically.
Yeah.
But I'm very interested in then what do you think that might look like if you are not learning. And we see that all the time. It's like people getting in, it's like, oh, you've modeled it in Revit. Great. Where's the documentation that's going to tell the builder of how he's going to build it? Is what you've just drawn actually going to be built? So same sort of part.
Exactly.
How do you see that being? to the principles and what to teach your graduates? Is it going to be more get out to site, great, we don't need you, you know, spending majority of your first few years doing the documentation? But this is going to be my question for firms of how do we now teach these skills when so much can be potentially automated?
It is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I still believe grads are sponges. Well, they should be sponges. And essentially you should expose them to all sorts of, well, to extend the analogy to all sorts of puddles around the place, and they need to just soak it all up, right? And maybe, you know, each part of the game is a different color and they've just become a sort of, you know, a spongy rainbow. But they've got experience still what this game is about. And we're still largely quite a traditional profession.
Yeah.
Right? It's still, essentially, you know, sure, we've got computers doing wonderful things, but like I say, we've got to come up with an idea and it's got to go. The process still exists, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in our registration assessments, we still start at the beginning of the process and we end at the end of the process. And,
yeah.
You know, it's got to happen. It's a really difficult question because I don't think architecture is going to change humanity fundamentally. I think we're a response to what humanity wants to exhibit or actually wants to see itself. But I just still can't get away from the idea that we, you know, we've got certain things that we need to fulfill, and there's a big unknown out there. And again, if we refer to AI as kind of what sits in my mind as representative of the big unknown, I don't really know what's coming. I can predict
else.
But whilst we know what we know at the moment, we've still got to figure out the fundamentals. Yeah, you add more strings to your bow with all the extra skills you can have, but no two people in the office are the same anyway, right? And so people kind of get drawn to what they're really interested in, and they pursue that like any passion in life. So advice to kids doing uni, I reckon take what uni is. Uni teaches you critical thinking, right? And then you take that mindset into whatever you do, whether it's architecture or medicine or, I don't know, into your trade or whatever you end up doing, you know, just.
Well, I think the other thing is, as you said, life is a journey too. You know, and I think we're going to see a massive change. And I mean, one of the problems that we can't get things built is that there's not enough tradespeople to build things, whereas, you know, you look at you and I.
Well, you've got a crunch coming in Queensland, haven't you?
What was that? That's, sorry,
you've got that crunch coming in Queensland.
Oh, we've got a massive infrastructure bill. Yeah. We're about
your Olympic construction is just going to subsume everything. It's going to take over.
Well, our biggest problem is also, and I don't know how you guys have gone. Well, as you're saying, it's not necessarily the size and scale of buildings, but you obviously get over a certain size, then you're going to have more of a union workforce. You've got a lot less builders. A lot of people have gone bust because the hardest thing about for people, builders, and everybody thinks the builders always make, you know, money. And yes, they do. But if you think about it, they've got to carry the labor costs. They've got to carry the material costs. They've got to take on all of the risk at the end of the day. And their margin rates are actually the lowest percentage margin rates out of the whole percentage. It's just they get to build the, you know, the $250 million building. So that percentage is very, very small, but it's a very, very fine line to what's doing.
That's massively risky.
Absolutely. Business. And that's why we see so many. So you've got, at the end of the day, though, it is all about the trades. And there isn't enough trades. And the problem is that those trades, you know, where I'm based, they're being paid a lot of money. And there's a lot of demand, and you can go and work on a certain site and get paid a lot. With that, my point is the one thing that AI won't be changing is what we physically do, right? And I'll be very interested to see if I look at my own children, the safest part, you know, if you look at all these AI experts, they're like, what would you tell your kids to do? It's like, go and be a plumber, right? Or be an electrician. The things that aren't going to change. So I really wonder how, and if I look at it, as professional services, the tradespeople are earning about twice or three times the amount of the professional services. Now, it's not easy, mind you, and there's a lot of risk in itself. But I really wonder in the future ahead how many people are going to be looking at parts that can't be automated or artificial intelligence isn't going to be, our education system is going to be very different. The way of how we interact and what we do. And somebody with young kids, I kind of go, what does this look like? But at the end of the day, your words around life is a journey, that wasn't necessarily words, but what you've done, every part and element that you've seen along the way, the tech will change, the elements will change, but at the end of the day, the game doesn't really change. Something needs to be built.
Yeah, no, that's essentially what I believe. It's like the builder's hammer gets upgraded. You know, it's nicer to hold. It's probably lighter, but you've still got to get that nail driven into that piece of wood, don't you? Well, here's a nail gun now. Terrible analogy.
Anyway, Hamish, thank you so much. We have gone all over the place, but we have definitely covered around some of the challenges and the opportunities ahead, and I think it's been a fantastic discussion. I'm sure we could keep talking for another 2 hours on things. Thank you so much.
It's been great fun. Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, Hamish, we always sort of end on something, which is around, do you have a podcast or a book or something else that you would recommend that people check out?
Wow. For some reason, a book that's come into my mind is 100 Years of Solitude, 100 Años de Soledad.
Wow.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And it's just a book of fantasy. I read it so many years ago that I need to read it again. And there's a not very good adaptation on Netflix, I think, but seriously, it's like it's a book that sort of weaves in and out of dream states. You never quite know where you are, but it's just full of that, my favorite word of the day, delight.
Hamish, it has been a delight.
Podcast, this one, of course.
Excellent. Thank you so much for all of your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
What a great conversation. And I absolutely loved that element around delight. I thought that was fantastic insights. And it's one of those things that no matter how much technology has changed in the last 30 years and is going to change in the next 30 years, that is the real part, the chefs, really, could we call it, of the industry that architects can bring. And it's something that I think that everybody needs to focus on in how can you actually bring that and enjoy it as you're doing it along. Thanks, Hamish, so much for all his time, and it's been a great podcast.